Do you ever wonder where your food comes from? That's what got us started on this adventure.
We talk to everyone we can to answer the question, what makes the Comox Valley food scene so special? Join us on our culinary exploration of this edible valley.
Welcome to the Edible Valley podcast. This is episode 178. My name is William Stringer. I'm the producer. To my right, I have Darren Howlett, who is writer and food entrepreneur.
Hello.
And opposite me, I have Sharon Jansen from Alder Lane Farmhouse Bakery.
Hello.
Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show. Sharon grew up in Vancouver and always had an entrepreneurial flair. She spent a lot of her time making things and selling them, starting with a sling style baby carrier, which she made and sold across Western Canada at craft fairs and small stores. At this point, she moved to Thetis Island as her husband got a new job at a kids camp, and Sharon decided to start experimenting with baking and selling cinnamon buns. And thus, we can find the very roots of Alder Lane Farmhouse Bakery. Later on, in the year 2000, she moved again, this time to Vancouver Island, to the Comox Valley, and after gaining more and more skill in baking, saw an opportunity to sell goods from a wicker basket in the schools and businesses across the valley. She started by placing a basket in the staff room at Miracle Beach Elementary and Black Creek Elementary, where teachers and staff paid for goods using the honor system, and quickly moved on to selling at greater places, offices, car dealerships, dentists, all over the place. And she was doing all of this from her little Volkswagen Jetta. That is a tough call for anybody. People started asking her at this point if she does any farmers markets, and she decided to scale up and sell at the wonderful Comox Valley Farmers Market. Her husband, who is an absolutely crucial support and ever there for her, retrofitted her equipment with wheels so she was able to operate efficiently and scale up and have better equipment and start baking more. Sharon, we have a lot to ask you about this incredible story of Canadian entrepreneurialism. Edible Valley is very proud to introduce again Sharon Jansen.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I am doing great.
Great. Wonderful intro, Will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm now sipping my tea.
Yeah, welcome to the episode. Thank you so much, Sharon, for joining us and bringing the wonderful little goodies that you've brought. I noticed, aside from the pastries on the table, you brought a little tote with you that maybe we'll get into in a minute.
Yes, some sourdough starters.
Perfect. Where Will's done a great job of summarizing how you got here. Can you give us a bit of a snapshot of your business right now?
Right now, Comox Valley Farmers Market is the main place where I sell. And the customers, this valley has been incredibly supportive of the valley market. And because of them and coming out even on rainy days when we're saying, oh, thank you so much for coming out, they're going, no, thank you. And that just surprises me every time. But I'm selling at the market, and I'm selling at out of my farmhouse as well on Friday afternoons as I'm prepping for market.
And how did that, that wasn't something you always did. That's something recent?
Yeah, I just started selling from the house in January. There was a snow day anticipated, and we thought, we've already got some baking done and market might be closed tomorrow, so let's just try and sell it from the house. And right. And it was well received, and we just carried on. And especially then COVID happened, and it seemed to be a good option for people to, they buy, actually my dining room window is set up. Right. People stand on the driveway in my dining room window and all my things are displayed there, and they pick what they want and I hand it through the little takeout window.
Oh, that's
and
fantastic.
And they just get a real kick out of it. They think it's hilarious.
That is hilarious. Maybe that's also, I think you were mentioning that was a assertion of how the name came to be, reminding people of, yes, there's a reason why it's...
Yes. So when they come down our driveway, well, first of all, we've got signs on the highway for when we're open, and then a sign at our driveway, and then they start coming down this long, long driveway. It's about 1,000 feet long, and thus it's called Alder Lane. And then they get inside of our house, which looks like a barn. So that's the farmhouse. So it's kind of a mouthful.
Right.
But it's just what happened.
It makes sense once you actually get there.
It makes sense, yeah.
Right. And it was a good opportunity to remind everybody where the name derives from. And yeah. You said, we had chatted a bit before turning on the mics here, and you had said something at one point you had considered, or you started off with a different name.
I did. When I was selling at the schools, I was going under a different name, Wellbred, and I don't know why I didn't carry on with that name, and now it's not an option because somebody down at Duncan, I believe, has that name, so I'll just stick with my Alder Lane Farmhouse Bakery.
Maybe we can get them on a podcast.
But the farmhouse aspect really played up to the fact that you were doing more than just baking.
That's right. When I started at the market, I was selling chickens and farmer sausage. We've got our own recipe for farmer sausage, Mennonite farmer sausage, that Butcher's Block makes for us.
Oh, wow.
And so we were selling that at the market and baking. It was just sort of an equal amount. Right. So we were just Alder Lane Farm, and then it kind of grew into more baking than farm products. And so we added the house, farmhouse.
And I didn't mean to undercut that by saying just baking. I mean, I realize that you're a fantastic baker, and the sheer volume of products and the momentum of your business is all based on the bake. Do you have any particular, I think, we sort of walked through the steps of what got you to baking, but is there any specific sort of products that you think that you've done that are maybe the linchpin, or are there particular products that you think sort of built your business versus others?
Absolutely. I'd say that cinnamon buns are just sort of the base. They're just the foundation, and pretty much everybody loves a cinnamon bun. Then one time, fairly early in when I was at Farmer's Market, a vegetable vendor said to me, "Hey, you should make croissants." And I looked at them like, yeah, and that's a lot of work. Do you realize what you're asking me to do?
Incredible amount of work.
I laughed, and then I was at a bookstore, and I was looking at some baking books, and I thought, I might just check and see what this is about. And so I started experimenting with it, and it very rapidly became my bestseller. But I was doing it all by hand until about 4 years ago when I got an actual dough sheeter.
Wow.
And
that
made a big difference.
I think the thing that a lot of people at home or who are listening might not realize is that I've known a few people that have been somewhat entrepreneurial and been able to bake a few goods at home, and you can put out some muffins, you can put out some cookies, some cakes, all things without buying or investing in equipment. But there's certain things, even on a small scale, that there's a commitment there. You have to seriously commit to some equipment, some heavy investments, just to even produce a small amount. And you're producing quite a bit. At what point did you realize that this wasn't going to work just with your mixer or your what have you?
Well, I didn't even really have a mixer other than a KitchenAid 6-quart to begin with. One day my hands were getting sore, and my husband had been asking me for ages if I wanted to get a bigger mixer.
Right.
And so my hands were getting sore, and I said on Tuesday, if I don't have a mixer by Friday, I quit. And we got a hold of one by Thursday, but didn't get it up and running until the following week. But that was thanks to a friend in Vancouver whose name is Alvin, and he tracked down a nice 20-quart ancient mixer, and we managed to get it over here, and I thus named my mixer Alvin after him for helping me get that first big piece of equipment. And then we moved on to a convection oven, a bigger convection oven, which I was saying to you, we got at Voodoo Lounge many, many years ago. And that was a big investment. And then the dough sheeter since then. And then I got the two convection ovens, two big commercial convection ovens. So that's the Duke and the Duchess. And the dough sheeter is Joe, after my financial backer who helped me purchase that.
That's hilarious.
My mom. Oh, yeah.
That's hilarious. It's funny that you, the naming of the equipment, I found that a lot of startup businesses, smaller businesses, like the non-corporate or massively built up businesses, you become so intimate with the machines that and they start to develop personalities, and you can't help but name them.
Yeah, and Alvin actually lost first gear.
Oh no.
And so then I was really hooped. I had him hand painted. He was a candy apple red. He was so pretty.
Wow.
And then I was in a real panic, and I phoned Hobart, and it's like, I need a machine now. And so it didn't quite happen as quickly as I wanted. So I'm trying to use Alvin with a plastic bag over him, because otherwise flour was flying everywhere. But then I did get my new mixer, and that's Mr. Smee. If you know your if you know your Peter Pan story, Mr. Smee is Hook's backup, and of course the mixer has a big hook. But Mr. Smee's really doing all the work.
Yeah, John and I had a business, and when we walked into it, a couple of the pieces of equipment were named, and at first we thought that was ridiculous, and then within weeks we realized each one of them had a personality, and you had the names fit. And then since then, I think John, in other efforts, has gone on to name all the equipment as well. You just have to do it. The scale there can, without divulging anything personal, but like scale-wise, you were starting off with roughly what to now? Like,
well,
were you producing
can say it
handful?
In hours, right? Like, okay. Initially, I was working maybe 4 hours producing and then 4 hours selling. And over the years, and especially this last year, it's ramped up to the fact that I'm paying out, hiring out at almost 30 hours.
Wow.
Some neighbor girls are coming in and doing things like even just stamping bags so that I've got a little advertising on my bags, to washing my pans for me. So when I come home from market on Saturday, I call my girl and she shows up and she washes all my pans, and I just go and sit on the back deck in the sun and listen to my canaries. And so I'm, you know, hiring out about 30 hours there and then working almost 40 hours myself.
Goodness.
So right there, it tells you that
You know,
from 4 hours to 40 hours just for myself. The ramping up started actually with hiring our daughter-in-law.
Oh, yeah.
Which was an incredible opportunity to have a relationship with her, and just to have the help. And she's intuitive. And yeah, it was an amazing, amazing opportunity. And it just got me kind of geared up to realize, hey, if I actually ask for help, I can build this. If I keep on trying to do it myself, I'm going to burn out.
So that's, she came on as sort of a multi-purpose at first?
Yeah, she came on a Wednesday when I was doing my croissants. So she was making my fillings for me. She was doing some of the laminating. I could just stand at the table and do all the actual shaping, and she would do some of the laminating. I would make all the dough still. You know, she was making, we do like an Eat More bar product well. So she was making those. And then she'd come and help us sell on Saturdays. Wasn't her favorite because she'd been of an introvert, but she did an amazing job. But now she's moved on to be an editor for Edible Magazine. And so we've had to seek elsewhere, and we've got some really amazing people helping us.
Yeah, it sounds like you sort of hired the neighborhood. Everybody that you were recounting was
three of my helpers are from the neighborhood, two 15-year-old girls. And my neighbor right across the street, a homeschooling mom. So she comes in the evenings. So we sit in our family room and watch TV or sit on the back deck during the summer and eat our dinner, and she's working away in my kitchen. It took a little while to get used to that, having somebody run my kitchen without me there. It's pretty cool. She comes to borrow something now, and she just walks into my kitchen and finds it and then walks out.
let's scale right back to the beginning a bit, if we could. You started off with other textiles. You were working with other textiles. Were you a baker of, like, personally, were you doing a lot of baking at home?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a Mennonite home. Mennonites are known for baking. Yes. There's a whole book called Mennonite Girls Can Cook. You know, so my mom was always making things without recipes. Mm-hmm. And so when I'd ask her for a recipe, it would just be, oh, a bit of this and throw in this. And when it feels right, then you know it's right. And it's okay. Yeah. So yeah, some of that stuff had to become intuitive. I always making cinnamon buns, that was always the backup, and so that's why it's just simply the foundation of the whole thing.
So it was sort of a natural progression at some point somewhere you decided to make extra for other people or something to that nature.
Yeah.
And at what point then, when you were making things for everybody, did you make that jump? Like, we'll definitely cover it over how that started, but what got you there? What flip that switch.
So back to when we moved from Thetis to here, it was, you know, the kids were going to these schools, and I thought, oh, how do the teachers, you know, if they forget a lunch or if they just want a treat, there's nothing around here. And I grew up a city kid, right? So there's always stores or restaurants or something around the corner. And so that's what just kind of made me think, oh, maybe I could just do this and I'll make a few bucks. And to be honest, I was making $75 a week doing that. And I was like, this is cool. That made me happy, right? Yeah. And I think that's been part of what has worked for me, is that whatever I'm doing has been enough. And then I think, oh, maybe I could do a little bit more. And each one was satisfying, right? And so now I feel again like I've kind of reached a threshold. I don't know that I want to go any bigger at this point.
Right.
I have people asking me, but because I'm baking out of my home, I can't do third-party sales. So I have to be really careful about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of natural pulling back of what I can produce. But, you know, at Farmer's Market, I'm, again, the way that customers support us there, I'm just kind of maxing out on those things.
So when you say third-party sales, that would be putting your things into stores.
Into stores.
Edible, that sort of island, thing. That sort of
yeah,
place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't even know if you'll recall this, but I recall when we first met and I have I do a lot of school lunches. I produce the food for a lot of the hot lunch programs. And I do remember approaching you about doing sheets of pastry of some
puff
sort.
Pastry.
I think that we were talking about doing some sausage rolls or some sort of cheese biscuit or something. It was an add-on product to something I was already doing. And I remember that look on your face. It must have been before you had the sheeter, because you were just no, I don't think I can provide that. But like let's keep in touch and talk in the future. And I've since moved to other products. I'm not chasing down that avenue, but I do remember watching, even just a few years ago, before you had sort of exploded as far as what you were offering.
My head went someplace with products, taking suggestions from customers. Like, for one thing, just even the people next door to us, the vegetable farmers who said, you know, why don't you make croissants? My motorcycle instructor said, hey, you should make chocolate croissants. And I hadn't even eaten a chocolate croissant prior to that. And I was like, oh, that's an idea. So you get some good ideas.
Yeah.
And then chocolate croissants are definitely one of my best sellers. And then it was chocolate almond croissants. And I served you an almond croissant here.
Yeah, fantastic.
But then you get weird ideas that you don't use. Like, you should use green tomatoes in your apple pie because it makes the crust crispy.
Interesting.
And I'm like, that's weird.
What? Yeah, I've never heard that.
I've got a quick question. What's the difference between a chocolate croissant and a pain au chocolat?
Nothing. Okay. English and French.
Yeah. Oh, is that it? Okay,
yeah.
That's it.
Great. And mine look different too. Mine is a traditional like croissant shape, but I actually have a layer of chocolate on the outside of chocolate pastry.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And then I have a chocolate bar that I make myself that goes on the inside. So okay, the pain au chocolat is more like just a rectangle
shape.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes has two pieces of chocolate in there, but right. I've never had a complaint that there's not enough chocolate.
Okay. Again, just because we mentioned it beforehand, you at one point you took a trip to Paris.
Yes.
And I'm curious if you'd sort of committed to the pain au chocolat there, or if you'd, obviously you got the idea here, but is that where you refined the idea, or did that fruit bear any fruit? Did it
what happened there was that I discovered that you could make the chocolate croissant into the chocolate almond croissant. I was already making an almond croissant, so it's a twice baked product, but then I realized if I had extra chocolate croissants, I could also make those into a twice baked, which means that I can have product on my table to the end of market. I will always have plain and chocolate croissants on my table because I bake extra, because they go into the freezer and then they come out and get twice baked with the frangipane in it and the almonds on top and all that sort of thing. And that's been something that I've learned about. How do I keep product on my table so that customers can come and not be disappointed that I'm sold out, right? So
absolutely.
You'll pretty well always find those two products on my table still, the chocolate and the plain. But then they make this magical return the next week with the twice baked. And I learned more about that when I was in Paris. But yes, I got to go with the Vancouver Island University baking program, which was an incredible honor and an incredible opportunity. And I was telling you that the first day we were at Puratos, we spent the first day learning about sourdough breads and laminated pastry, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And I went to my head instructor at the end of that day and I said, if this 2-week trip is over in this one day, I'm fine with that, because I have learned so much. It transformed my thinking about bread, and that again has become this huge thing for me is the sourdough breads. And that was just an amazing experience. And
my next question was going to be, did that bear any did you just decide on new things to create out
absolutely.
Of that trip?
Absolutely. Yeah. The sourdough breads was where I went from there. I was making just what I kind of call Susie Homemaker breads, just lots of yeast, get it made fast, you know, make it happen. And now, you know, just before I came here, I got my starters going for my breads that I'm going to be baking up tomorrow. And it's, you know, a 24 to 48 hour process to get those things going. And I do the sourdoughs as well as what's called a Poulish method, which is a very tiny amount of yeast in a large, like that'll make 12 loaves of bread. I use maybe 2 teaspoons of yeast in total. And that's the Poulish method. And that's why I do my baguettes and my French white and my dill and onion bread. And wow. my canary bread, which is 100% whole wheat with seeds in it. But those are all made with very minimal amounts of yeast, but not a sourdough starter. But it, wow. again, is like a almost a 24-hour process.
Do you mind if, I mean, you did bring a few samples
here. Open
I'd love
those
to,
guys up.
I'd love to take a quick sample. Or do you have anything to say about any of these?
Well, for sure, they've all got names too, the sourdough starters.
I'm sorry, so, I've got Ryan here.
So Ryan, that isn't very creative. He's 100% rye.
Yeah.
So now,
That's very good. Very good.
So then there's try Sarah.
Sarah.
So
okay.
Sarah is a biblical name. She was very old when she became a mother. So this is an ancient grain, and it's actually grown at Stonecroft, which is my neighbor in Black Creek. That's 100% Stonecroft. So do you notice that she smells very earthy?
Yeah, very earthy. There's definitely a tiny bit of a minerality to it, and it's very subtle.
Like, yeah, so now do Lego.
Okay,
Lego. So Lego is white, and I actually am a little lazy when I start my starters. I just take a teaspoon of Lego, and then I add like the Neepawa wheat, which is the Stonecroft wheat.
I gotta smell this again.
So it's my building block, so that's why it's called Lego.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you notice that it's got more of a, like a acidic smell?
Yeah.
But it's not so earthy.
Right.
Like, so you can see how each of the breads is going to take on different flavors.
Yeah,
based
absolutely. I would say that this one, I can already tell.
Like a vinegary kind of smell.
Exactly. There's a bit of a note of a loaf of bread that I can't put my finger on, but I definitely have tasted that before.
Yeah.
Again, coming back to the Ryan's very strong, very pungent, but not in an offensive way.
Yeah. So Martin. Mm-hmm. Martin was the head instructor when we went to VIU.
Okay.
Or when I went to Paris with VIU. He runs Serafina's Oven down in Duncan right now. And so I went and did a sourdough course with him over a weekend. And he gave us that starter. So that's 50-50 organic rye. Rye and organic whole wheat. And so
that's
I just named that starter after Martin.
I think that's beautiful. Like that kind of mellows out that strong pungency of the rye, but there's almost something comforting there.
So now if you put them in order, Martin, Ryan, Sarah, Lego, mm-hmm. you have MRSL, and that's Mrs. L in there.
Yeah.
So Mrs. L,
MRSL, yeah.
Mrs. L, I take her and I spread her out on a piece of silicone mat.
Sure.
And I dry it. And I actually give that away as a sourdough starter to my customers who want to start their own.
Yeah.
And so you just dry it and flake it. And so she's everything. Mrs. L is everything.
Oh, yeah. That's got a lot of body.
Yeah.
That's great. I've got to ask, too, that... So you've got all this sourdough knowledge and appreciation and love.
I have a look on my face right now going, don't ask me any specific questions. I don't know anything scientific.
Not into the chemistry of it. But I'm just saying that, did you notice that during COVID, that was sort of the first trend as COVID hit was that everyone took to making sourdough?
Absolutely. That's when I started doing the starters, doing the Mrs. L starters and drying the flakes. I've given away between 150 and 200 of those little packages, to which people say, well, aren't you like giving away your business? And it's like, no, not at all. Yeah. Like, it's been the least expensive advertising I've ever done,
right?
Really. And it's just encouraging people to try this at home.
Yeah.
You know, and either they try it and take off with it, and that's great, or they're like, I really appreciate what you're doing.
Right.
I'm going to keep on buying from you because this is a lot of work. But I've also created a sourdough starter kit. So I include 2 of those starters and 3 linen couches. So when you rise your bread, it's in a piece of fabric, and the linen keeps it from sticking. And I include a recipe in there and how to take care of your starter and the three linen couche and the two starters, and then two links to videos that I've done on YouTube so that they can figure out how to do it all and get some help in that. And so that's a $25 kit that I'm selling at market as well. So
and that's the other thing too, I think, that a lot of people don't realize is that, yes, you know, maybe you are literally giving away something that you've created, but for them to recreate what you can create, just having the starter there isn't nearly enough. Like, there's the way you do it, the method, the length, the duration, the ingredients you use are going to give you a very different thing than somebody's able to make at home. So yours, it still keeps your bread unique and individual, even though people are starting at the same starting point as you.
Yeah.
That's great. That's fantastic. So have you branched out in other ways? I'm not saying that you should. I'm just sort of curious if there's other little nuggets like this that you've hidden.
No, I don't. I mean, in terms of my product line, that sort of thing? Not really. I mean, I've always done pie. I've got brownies. I've got, you know, basically when a family comes, I'm hoping that each family member will find something that they want, right? And, you know, I keep on being asked, do you do scones? Do you do muffins? And it's like, you know what? Seaside Sweets down the way there, she does them. Because I can't do it all. But there's ways that I do things that it's not a ton of extra work, but I can produce the brownies, I can do a peanut butter bar, I can do the pies, and
And what's your favorite?
These guys, the almond croissants,
fantastic,
are my favorite. And like the sourdough breads, like I actually go to bed dreaming about my toast the next morning. I really do. It's like, that's awesome. Oh, I hope I'm hungry sourdough in the morning. Is tasty. Yeah. My pumpkin sun sourdough, that's probably one of my favorites. My grandson named that one. I said, if there's pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds in it, what would you name this bread? So pumpkin, he called sun. It pumpkin sun. So when you toast it, those seeds get even toastier. They're already toasted when they go in, but they get even toastier, and it's just...
Yeah, I love roast pumpkin seeds. So I have one final question, and Will, you've got a question.
Yes, I actually did want to know what other local ingredients you're using to make your products.
Right. That's something that I really want to do, but of course in baking it's hard to get local almonds and local sugar, and I've managed to get some local flour in there with my neighbor at Stonecroft, but I also try and use, well, I am using eggs from Ridgewood, and they were actually my neighbors on Kelland Road. We've got a lot of things happening just on our road. Using lard from Raised Right Ranch, dill from any neighbor that will give me dill, apples from any neighbor. Our son actually has a couple apple trees at his house, so I've used that. Rhubarb from a neighbor. Grew my own pumpkins this week, or this year, this week. Actually, I didn't actually do that because I'm not a gardener. I don't have any time for it. That was grown at our place, but by my husband and some friends. And then garlic scape. I've done some garlic scape in my breads as well. So the dill goes into the bread as well. So yeah, just try and do what I can.
Right. Yeah. Use as local as you can. Yeah. And my final question is, what does the future hold? Where are you?
That's a good question, because I'm kind of sneaking up to 60, and it's like, how long can my body do this? Right. And I think that's all part of getting people to help me do this hiring out, that definitely a Friday ends better than it used to. I used to just like collapse at the end of Friday, and then I had to get up at 2:30 or 3 in the morning on Saturday, which is when my croissants get baked up. So by hiring out and helping, having really good people helping me, I can see myself going a little bit longer and further. But as it hasn't come up here, that my husband has MS. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of this whole business growing was, how can I supplement income? Because CPP disability isn't like a real...
No.
it helps a bit, but...
No.
Yeah, so how can I supplement and make things work for us? I want to try and work as long as I can.
Right.
And so, you know, as long as my body will do this, I want to keep doing it. And certainly as long as this valley is supporting a business like mine, and they are just, I wouldn't be where I am at without the people from this valley. Like, they are just so supportive. It's incredible. Well,
I mean, you can see it at the market. Yeah. I mean, I remember always, we were positioned, our booth was positioned just across from yours, and you could always see that you always had a lineup and you were always sold out.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Disney lineup now with COVID. They've made they've made these barriers kind of thing, and it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's temporary. I'm sure it'll change.
Yeah. Well, it's actually helped us that because people now start at one end of our booth and they work long and they're actually seeing all our products.
Yeah. Nice.
They didn't always see everything before because they just make a beeline for what they wanted, right? And now it's much more organized and people see the scope.
Well, that's, I mean, that's great. And it's good to know that you'll still be sticking with it for a while. And even if you start to, I'm assuming even if you start to remove yourself from it a bit, it seems like you've got the infrastructure there to keep things going strong.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sitting in with us and bringing everything. Yeah, we never get gifts like this. You brought a lot of great gifts. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Sharon.
Thank you for coming on.
All right. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to another episode of the Edible Valley Podcast.
We thank you for supporting us and the people that make up your food community. Follow us on your preferred social media at Edible Valley for recipes, tips, behind the scenes, and more. You never know where we'll be next in your Edible Valley.
All right. Thanks for, that was a little bit longer than normal, thank you. It's funny, because I'm so used to having John and knowing what John's going to ask, so I always try to ask things that are silly.
This is an Edible Valley production.